It's goodbye until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Billahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah. وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Top stories: Iran slams fresh U.S. sanctions on the country, saying Washington's so-called maximum pressure policy against Tehran runs contrary to any diplomatic breakthrough. The U.S. Senate throws its support behind a major weapons sale to Saudi Arabia that includes advanced missiles. And the Russian president says Moscow is considering or concerned about NATO's growing presence near his country's borders amid tensions over Ukraine. Welcome to the program. Our top story: Iran warns the United States that imposing more sanctions will not create any leverage in the Vienna talks. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says such moves show anything but seriousness and goodwill. He notes that Washington's so-called maximum pressure policy against Tehran runs contrary to any diplomatic breakthrough. The comments come after the U.S. Treasury Department announced fresh sanctions on a number of Iranian entities and nationals over alleged human rights violations. Tehran and the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have so far held 7 rounds of talks in Vienna with the aim of removing anti-Iran sanctions. The latest round of negotiations is now in recess and will resume on Thursday. All right, on that story, right here at our studios, I'm joined by Mr. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh. He is a writer and political analyst who's right here with us. Mr. Ghulamzadeh, it's good to have you with us. I'd like to get your reaction to Iran's stance regarding this recent sanctions against Iranian individuals.
Thank you very much. Just between the 2 rounds of the talks in Vienna, as you just mentioned about them, it shows that the Americans are trying to show that they have something to put pressure on Iran when they actually do not have that power. We remember that in the late months of the Trump administration, who were more hawkish than the current administration in the United States, they admitted that their sanctions against Iran has no more power to be forced against Iran, and they don't have anything more to put sanction on. So any sanctions right now is not going to have any impact on Iranian life, economy, or whatsoever.
I'm sorry to jump in there, but don't you think there is some interest, and rightly taken, in the timing that, Mr. Ghulamzadeh, it happens right in the middle of these talks?
That's the point. In the negotiations right now, time is against the West and the Americans. Mm-hmm. And because Iran did follow the JCPOA, even for a year, the whole year after the United States withdrew from the JCPOA, and after that it began to reduce its commitment to the JCPOA. And so as time passes, it is in favor of Iran, and it's adding to its enriched uranium, the level of enrichment and such things, and it is against the Western countries. And by these sanctions, the Americans are trying to have some chips on the table to bargain on, and to just adding to the sanctions and designations to have something to discuss on the table, to say that, okay, to remove these sanctions and these designations, you need to give up something in return. And they are actually trying to have that word on the table. But in another perspective, you can say that another point of these sanctions is that the Americans are trying to say that we have some power to say. The Biden administration is terribly in trouble in domestic politics, and it is under attack especially by Republicans in terms of foreign policy. And it has not any achievements, and the story in Afghanistan was a total failure for Biden administration. And because of these pressures, they are playing a theater, actually, to show that we have some power in foreign policy, and we can do something against, for example, Iran. In the middle of the negotiations, we are putting some pressure on Iran, we are adding to the sanctions, which, as I said, it is more a theater than a real politic and realistic political measurement, actually.
Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting that you say that's a political theater, and I wonder, Mr. Ghulamzadeh, actually I do have some ideas. You please tell our viewers that who do you think they're showing that political theater to?
First of all, the people and public opinion inside the America, and also the others who are not in the talks, because those countries, 4+1, who are in the negotiations are involved, and they know what is going on. And Iran has offered the text, and Iran has offered a logical proposal, and is waiting, actually, for the response from the Western countries, and is insisting that it should be done as soon as possible. But the other countries, the other people who are not involved in the negotiations, are the target for this message that the Americans are trying to send to them, to the world, that we have that power, we are still in power, and we have the position to impose some sanctions against the others, and we are so involved in the international politics that we can impose sanctions on a prison in a corner of Iran, and we are following the developments in a country like Iran. And the same story I would expect in a couple of days. There is going to be a conference hosted by the Americans and the Western countries, where it seems that it is expected that a new round of sanctions against countries like China, Iran, and Russia might be imposed there as well. Again, that is the same story. This scenario is nothing new and has happened in the past, is happening right now, and is expected to happen in the future as well, because the sanction regime has fallen, has failed, and the Americans have realized that, but they are trying to keep the face of the sanctions and to show that these sanctions is still working.
Fair point. That's Mr. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, writer and political analyst with us at our studios. Thank you very much, sir. You have a very good day. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says that the U.S. must remove all its sanctions if it wishes to return to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. In an opinion piece in the Russian daily Kommersant, Amir Abdullahian noted that Iran continued to fully comply by JCPOA even a year after the U.S. unilateral withdrawal. He says his country was hoping for effective measures from the three European signatories, namely Britain, France, and Germany, but they failed to take the right standpoint. Iran's top diplomat says Tehran will only return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal if the U.S. guarantees that the past will not repeat itself. He insisted that Iran will not accept anything beyond the JCPOA, and the negotiations cannot go on forever.
The U.S. Senate backs sales of advanced weaponry to Saudi Arabia following the kingdom's plea for a resupply of its military equipment. $650 million arms package sale comes despite opposition from the Biden administration. Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders also warned that exporting more missiles to Saudi Arabia will escalate the conflict between the Saudi-led coalition and Yemen. Earlier, Saudi Arabia appealed to the United States and its allies in Europe and the Persian Gulf for resupplies of weaponry. Riyadh claims it needs missiles for defensive purposes while the kingdom pushes ahead with its devastating war on Yemen. Years-long onslaught has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and displaced millions of others. Political commentator Hamza Shaiban says the Saudi war on Yemen will continue as long as the West continues its support for the aggression against the Yemenis.
I mean, U.S. doesn't seem to be willing to change the way they're dealing with the situation in Yemen. They're not willing to back off and stop supporting Saudi Arabia logistically and with intelligence. And honestly, like, I don't see U.S. changing their role in this war. Saudi Arabia also are not willing to back off, although they're losing a lot of, you know, economically they're being damaged. Internationally, you know, they're now very well known for committing war crimes in Yemen, and I don't see that Saudi Arabia would stop this war unless really the Western governments stop backing them and supply them with weapons. Otherwise, I don't think this war will end, and the Yemeni people and the government in Sana'a will continue defending Yemen and the people in Yemen, and probably increasing the number of attacks to the you know, to the military bases in Saudi Arabia and to strategic economical sites there.
Local media report a fresh airstrike by the Saudi-led coalition on the northern Yemeni city of Sa'ada. Three civilians have been killed in the strike that targeted the Sahar district. The attack is the latest in a bout of Saudi airstrikes on Yemen. Saudi warplanes have conducted over 130 strikes on Sana'a and other major Yemeni cities over the past 5 days. Meanwhile, the Yemeni army says they have downed the U.S.-made spy plane. Army spokesman Yahya Sari' says the aircraft was targeted in the Juba area of Ma'arib province. A virtual summit between U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin is now over. The two sides say Ukraine dominated the discussion. During the meeting, Putin complained about NATO's growing presence near Russian borders. He also asked for legal guarantees that a military alliance will not expand further east. The Russian president expressed concern about what he called NATO's dangerous attempts to develop Ukrainian territory. Putin told his U.S. counterpart it was wrong to put the blame for the tensions over Ukraine on Russia. Biden, for his part, expressed concern about Moscow's actions with regard to Kyiv. He said Russia will face strong economic sanction in case of a military escalation against Ukraine. The White House says it has given the Kremlin zero concessions about Ukraine.
I'm not going to characterize President Putin's side of the conversation and or go into details in terms of what they discuss, because I think they need to have that space to be able to have a robust exchange. But I will tell you clearly and directly, he made no such commitments or concessions. He stands by the proposition that countries should be able to freely choose who they associate with.
Jake Sullivan says if Russia invades Ukraine, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which carries Russian gas to Europe, will be suspended. Washington and Moscow have agreed to continue talks on Ukraine. In the past weeks, Russia has been accused of preparing for an incursion into its southern neighbor. Moscow has vehemently rejected the allegation, calling it hysteria. The Kremlin says the presence of Russian soldiers near Ukraine is in response to a troop buildup on the other side of the border. Political commentator Mr. Jim Kavanaugh believes that the Ukrainian government is trying to drag the U.S. into a conflict with Russia.
I think we have to understand that really what's likely to happen, or where the real danger is, that the fascist forces who are behind the Kiev regime want to attack the Donbas region, the Lugansk and Donetsk republics that have achieved the separatist republics in eastern Ukraine. And there has been an agreement about that since 2015, the Minsk agreement, which has not held up very well because the Kiev regime and the Kiev military continues to shell and continues to attack across the line. So I think there's a tremendous amount of impatience on the part of the real militarist fascists in the Kiev regime to get back the Donbas region and the eastern. And the real danger is that they will make a move hoping, either with the permission of the United States, with the support of the United States, or more likely, hoping that the United States will not, and Europe, will not be able not to support them in doing that, dragging them in the way that the CIA tried to drag JFK into the Bay of Pigs. And if there is a direct military attack, this is what Putin's saying, that if the Russians are preparing for anything, if they're preparing for repelling such a thing, they will not let Donbas, I think, be attacked directly by the Ukrainian military without responding.
Australia joins the U.S. in diplomatically boycotting the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. Prime Minister Scott Morrison says government officials will not accompany Australian athletes in the upcoming games. He says China's failed to respond to several issues raised by Canberra, including alleged human rights abuses. A day earlier, Washington also announced a diplomatic boycott of the Winter Olympics, citing a similar pretext. The decision angered China, which warned that the U.S. will pay a price for its mistakes. Beijing says the United States is plotting to disrupt the international event, but it'll fail. South Korea is reporting yet another record high in the number of daily COVID infections for the third consecutive week. There have been more than 7,000 daily infections in one day, putting hospitals under a lot of strain. Authorities are struggling to secure enough beds for patients. The government is also mobilizing additional personnel to oversee patients who are treating themselves at home. Deaths and severe cases are also on a rising trend. The Southeast Asian country that is praised for its success in containing the pandemic lifted distancing rules and reopened businesses last month. Nearly 92% of the population is now fully vaccinated. European Union health ministers meet in Brussels to discuss rising COVID-19 cases and growing pressure on the bloc's health services. Vaccine hesitancy is being singled out as the driving force behind hospital admissions, deaths, and new restrictions. Jerome Hughes is in the Belgian capital.
Figures have just emerged which show that less than 55% of the population in six EU nations have received a COVID-19 vaccine, despite plenty being available. Experts say vaccine hesitancy is the main reason behind rising coronavirus cases, hospitalizations, deaths, and the reintroduction of restrictive measures across the 27-country bloc. EU health ministers have been meeting in Brussels to take stock of the crisis.
So is this not a massive failure from the EU? Should the EU not be putting much more of its effort into trying to convince people to take the vaccines?
Growing pressure on hospitals means that non-COVID patients are being neglected, and those without private health insurance are falling between the cracks. As EU health ministers met on Tuesday, so too did the bloc's finance ministers. The message was both old and new risks to the EU economy are materialising. Bulgaria and Romania stand out as having the lowest vaccination rates in the EU. Fears over new variants have been heightened by the Omicron mutation. At the start of the pandemic, EU nations closed their borders and turned their backs on Italy, which was buckling under the pressure. It was left to Russia to fly in emergency medical supplies. It's a story the bloc's leaders never talk about. In a veiled reference to it here, health ministers say there must be better cooperation between member states when the next crisis emerges. Jerome Hughes, the Council of the EU, Brussels.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration released its first global posture review with the continuation of a Cold War stance towards China and Russia. We're prepared for you an article written by Jeremy Scahill. The piece is titled Biden to Pentagon, Keep the War Machine Running. The article has been taken from the Intercept website. Our After 2 decades of unceasing warfare in West Asia and Central Asia, the Biden administration has unveiled its first comprehensive review of the deployment of U.S. forces globally. And it envisions a virtually unchanged military footprint, with a sharpened commitment to the bipartisan policy of Cold War-style hostility towards Russia and China. The Biden administration chose to release only scant details of its global posture review on 29th of November, but in its bare-bones unclassified summary and in remarks from Pentagon officials, the White House made clear that the U.S. military footprint will remain largely unchanged. A senior Pentagon official told reporters during a background briefing on the global posture review, he said, "We endeavor to be as transparent as possible, but to avoid giving our adversaries any advantage, we need to protect details of any immediate changes in our posture." The unclassified summary contained little substantive news. It portrays the steady expansion of U.S. military assets in Indo-Pacific region, the geographical term used by the Pentagon to describe a vast swathe of eastern hemisphere encircling China, as necessary to supposedly deter potential Chinese military aggression and threats from North Korea. While the Pentagon has offered few specifics about President Joe Biden's future plans, the review does indicate an evolving strategy to further expand military capabilities near China, including through leveraging existing partnerships. Mara Carlin, the acting Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, in a briefing with reporters, said, "In Australia, you'll see new rotational fighter and bomber aircraft deployments. You'll see ground forces training and increased logistics cooperation," adding, "So we're doing a lot that will hopefully come to fruition in the coming years." The Pentagon also confirmed that it was establishing a permanent attack helicopter squadron and military division headquarters in South Korea. Citing President Biden's reversal of former President Donald Trump's plan to cap the number of U.S. troops in Germany at 25,000, the Pentagon said its review strengthens the U.S. combat-credible deterrent against Russia and enables NATO forces to operate more effectively. It did not offer any new specifics, directly noting the ongoing tensions surrounding Ukraine's future and Russian troops' movements near the border. Mara Carlin said, "We're actually increasing troops in Germany to bolster NATO's capacity." Meanwhile, Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby, a retired Rear Admiral, at the briefing with Mara Carlin, said the Biden administration will continue to provide security assistance items, both lethal and non-lethal, to Ukraine, claiming, "This administration remains committed to helping Ukraine military defend itself, defend its territorial integrity, and defend its people." In a gaffe that underscored the Biden administration's Cold War posturing, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin on 2nd of December referred to Russia as the Soviet Union, claiming the best case, though, is that we won't see any incursion by the Soviet Union into Ukraine. The review also makes clear that, for now, U.S. troops will continue to operate in a so-called counterterrorism capacity throughout West Asia and Africa, with no immediate divergence from Trump-era deployments. The summary states that the Pentagon will conduct additional analysis on during posture requirements in West Asia and is assessing whether it has an appropriately scoped posture to monitor purported threats from regional extremist organizations in Africa. At present, the United States has 2,500 publicly acknowledged troops on the ground in Iraq and an additional 900 military personnel in Syria. While the Biden administration has not maintained a frenetic pace of drone strikes favored by Joe Biden's predecessors, it has conducted strikes in several countries. On 29th of August this year, an airstrike in Afghanistan during the U.S. withdrawal killed 10 innocent Afghan civilians, including 7 children. The unclassified review makes no mention of the role drone strikes will play in Joe Biden's emerging military strategy. Mara Carlin said that the Pentagon is reviewing assets and platforms that were deployed in Afghanistan that may be freed up for use elsewhere as a result of the withdrawal. In June, President Biden submitted a summary to Congress of ongoing troop deployments and combat-equipped forces, stating that such engagements are consistent with the War Powers Act. President Biden wrote, U.S. counterterrorism forces continue to operate under the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, adding that the United States has deployed combat-equipped forces to several locations in the United States Central, European, Africa, Southern, and Indo-Pacific commands, areas of responsibility. President Biden's letter to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was an unclassified summary accompanied by a secret appendix, not available for public consumption. Joe Biden wrote to Nancy Pelosi, "If necessary, in response to terrorist threats, I will direct additional measures to protect the people and interests of the United States," adding, "It is not possible to know at this time the precise scope or the duration of the deployments of United States armed forces that are or will be necessary to counter terrorist threats to the United States." President Biden acknowledged that U.S. occupation forces remain on the ground in Yemen to supposedly conduct operations against al-Qaeda terrorists in the Arabian Peninsula and also Daesh terrorists. In the letter, President Biden reiterated his dubious claim that he had ended support for offensive Saudi operations against Yemeni revolutionary forces in Yemen, but acknowledged that the United States has more than 2,700 troops underground in Saudi Arabia, ostensibly to protect United States forces and interests in the region against actions by resistance groups. President Biden said, U.S. forces provide air and missile defense capabilities and support the operation of United States fighter aircraft. The U.S. also maintains substantial capabilities in the Horn of Africa, despite Donald Trump's withdrawal of many military personnel from Somalia. Those capabilities are mostly in Kenya and in Djibouti, for purposes of staging for the so-called counterterrorism and counter-piracy operations in the vicinity of the Horn of Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. Nick Tursa's reporting that challenged the assertion that the U.S. has entirely withdrawn from Somalia, and Nick Tursa has uncovered what appears to be some creative accounting by U.S. Special Operations Command Africa. On 27th of November, more than 1,000 National Guard troops from Virginia and Kentucky began deploying as part of Task Force Red Dragon to the Horn of Africa, where they will serve at forward operating bases. It is reportedly the Virginia Guard's largest single unit mobilization since Second World War. The deployment comes as the military and humanitarian situation in Ethiopia has worsened over the past year. Ethiopia's leader, Abiy Ahmed, is facing a significant insurgency in the Tigray region that could topple the government. According to President Biden, some 800 U.S. troops remain in Niger, with additional forces in the Sahel and Chad basin regions, to conduct airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance operations, and to provide support to African and European partners conducting the so-called counter-terrorism operation in the region, including by advising, assisting, and accompanying these partner forces. The Biden administration is kicking a number of major decisions on the role of U.S. so-called counter-terrorism forces in Africa and West Asia down the road, as it focuses attention on Moscow and Beijing.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Flashback. After his dismissal from Julius Baer in the Cayman Islands in 2003, Elmer returned to Zurich, where he found a new job. With documents in his possession that were incriminating to the bank, he posed a threat to Julius Baer, and the bank hired up to 10 private detectives to watch him. This intimidation by private detectives took place in 2004 and 2005. At that time, Rudolf Elmer and his family repeatedly filed complaints against X for harassment, but the Zurich prosecutor systematically refused to open an investigation. Rudolf Elmer then responded using the means available to him by sending his data to the Swiss tax authorities and a financial magazine.
The journalist just chose to do nothing. He didn't investigate the data. He just broke the story that the data were stolen, and that's it.
To prevent future crises, we'll identify jurisdictions that fail to cooperate, including tax havens, and take action to defend our financial system.
We have agreed that there will be an end to tax havens that do not transfer information on request. The banking secrecy of the past must come to an end.
The offshore banking system emerged from the financial crisis stronger than ever. Once again, Rudolf Elmer looked for a way to rock the system.
Mr. Rudy Elmer, please welcome him to discuss his story, his case, and the issues it raises. Thank you.
Good morning. I would like to tell you the short story first about what happened to me, and then the second part will be then about the real matter. Now, the The short story is, and it's a very simple one, I was in the Cayman Islands, and there was a kind of a mouse tail. Mouse tail. I started to pull on it a bit.
Mr. Elmer has been fighting his case for some 5 years, I believe, to, in one way or another, draw attention to this data. Of course, we don't know whether he is our source or not. We are structured in such a way that we do not know that. However, he certainly has something important and has had something very important to say about this matter. And I understand he is in a position to have more to say and more to give to the world to help them understand these sort of corrupt practices.
The Guardian did mention 40, as many as 40 politicians were possibly involved in this. Can you state that possibly we're talking about 40 politicians?
I made that statement, so I can state it, yes.
The problem is about the politicians who have hidden money in Switzerland. Because this is what gives the banks protection and power. This is why it's very difficult to protect whistleblowers, whether Falciani or Elmer or Birkenfeld. In Europe, no national government will help him. Zero. Why would they try to help Rudy when the Swiss bankers could actually attack them by disclosing the names of their politicians who have money in Switzerland?
I came back to Switzerland to take the bull by the horns and show society what the Swiss bank secrecy really means.
Every trial against Elmer resulted in media coverage on what Swiss banks wanted to keep hidden. The press conference held 2 days before in London brought the international press thronging to Zurich. During the hearing, the prosecutor increased the sentence. She now considered 8 months of prison without parole for Elmer, instead of 8 months suspended sentence, as she considered Elmer's new delivery of data to Assange as a provocation to the court. Here, Rudolf Elmer was being prosecuted for his first leak in 2005, long before he was in touch with WikiLeaks. He stood accused of having broken banking secrecy by sending a CD of data to the Swiss tax authorities and to the magazine Cash. But he was above all accused of having sent threatening emails to Julius Baer employees. Like this message, "Hi, dirty pig, my hunter is after you. He will be after you tomorrow, or in a week, or a month, but he will be there." Sent by Robin Hood, the email came from Mauritius, where Rudolf Elmer lived at the time, but he denies having sent it. He did, however, admit to having sent an email to the bank, threatening to send the data in his possession to neo-Nazi groups. Julius Baer attracts a large Jewish clientele.
He said he made many mistakes because he was under pressure. They put him under pressure, in psychological pressure, kind of a mobbing, etc. Elmer never wanted to have money. And quite to the contrary, others, I mean, Kieber in Vaduz or Falciani in Geneva, other cases, they said, I want some millions and I go to the Secret Service. Elmer sent his data to the tax man. I mean, the tax authorities and the papers, the press.
Thank you.
guilty of threatening behavior,
no, Jack,
right?
He's guilty in most points.
Banking secrecy.
He has to pay 240 times 30 French.
The central issue of the trial is to decide whether the Swiss law on banking secrecy includes data from the Cayman Islands. Two theories abound.
Heidi, what happened yesterday when we left you?
Basically, we drove home and Rudy was having a little nap in the car because he was exhausted after the whole day. And I felt like I was hungry and wanted to have something to eat. And we had a friend with us and we were going into our car subterranean garage. And two cars were following us inside. I didn't think of anything. Again, two black BMW, Skodas, and black cars. And once we had parked and Rudy opened the door, they jumped out of the car and said, Mr. Irma, you are arrested. And we were like stone-faced. We couldn't believe what just had happened.
This arrest had nothing to do with the trial that had taken place the day before. This new judicial investigation was triggered by Elmer's recent handover of data to Julian Assange.
I was anxious about Helena because she was alone in the house. Private files, banking files, personal banking files, personal health files, even unpaid bills were taken. They knew that everybody is exhausted from the day. Would not allow me to see her in the face. And she was in tears, having policemen around again. She was in tears they would take him away, which they did. And it's a trauma, and she is not the first trauma she had lived through, and she knew exactly what would come.
Could you confirm that Mr. Elmer is here in this prison?
No.
You can't confirm.
No comment.
And no visit?
No comment.
And no visit?
No visit, no comment.
Dear David, how is the world treating you and your family? There's not much going on here besides the usual questioning. My health is deteriorating slowly but surely. However, I don't wish to complain. I'll survive as usual. By the way, I won success at the Federal Supreme Court. The Prosecutor's Office of the State of Zurich now has to investigate the whole issue of harassment by the private detectives. This was a real setback for the Zurich Department of Justice, whose continued decisions to not open an investigation were considered arbitrary by the Supreme Judicial Authority of Switzerland. While Rudolf Elmer was in prison, Bank Julius Baer had some legal issues. The bank agreed to pay a 50 million euro fine to Germany to avoid prosecution for assistance in tax fraud. In the US, the bank was indicted on a conspiracy charge. A New York court accused it of having helped wealthy US taxpayers to hide over $600 million from the tax authorities in Switzerland. Meanwhile, without any evidence against him, Rudolf Elmer remains in prison, in custody for 187 days under strict conditions.
My family, my wife wasn't allowed to visit me for 6 months. My daughter, I could see only every fortnight for an hour. There was a window between us, so the family had a difficult time. Now, on my side, I was in a cell and 23 hours locked in, but I'm still the same person. I still haven't changed. I still think I have done the right thing. And my recommendation today is to blow the whistle anonymously. That's the only way, because there is no protection in law for whistleblowers. On the contrary.
Rudolf Elmer's time in prison only strengthened his convictions. He now spends his time in specialized seminars on tax havens in order to feed his fight.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us for this, our annual meeting of the task force, focusing this year on the shadow financial system.
How did you convince the people in the Isle of Man to say their privacy is not being violated by automatic information exchange?
Legitimate privacy versus the legitimate need to exchange information. You know, there are some countries in the world where tax offences carry the death penalty, and I say that against...
I have enormous sympathy for Rudy Elmer. I think that Swiss law may have been drawn to its furthest point to justify keeping him in jail for 6 months without the evidence being made available as to whether or not he actually broke Swiss law.
This was the power of the state being used to support fundamentally an illicit, well, let's be blunt about it, an illegal activity, tax evading. But tax evasion is the basis of the Swiss economy. You know, that's what the Swiss banks work on since 1934, when Switzerland put their banking secrecy in place to deliberately help people from other countries evade tax. All the other stories about why they created their banking secrecy are rubbish. They did it to help people evade tax, and they still are.
November the 17th, 2011, Rudolf Elmer went to the High Court in Zurich for his appeal trial.
We have no final sentence. The general attorney has to look for more evidence. We have to go further in the details with the general attorney how to provide them the data they need without violating the bank secrecy of any customer.
Is it possible?
I think so.
How?
You will see.
It's not only a slap in the face of the prosecution office, it's also a slap in the face of the judge who found me guilty in January. And it's a slap in the face as well on the other prosecution office which was responsible for putting me in prison 19th January after the trial. The legal or the judicial system itself concludes they have done a poor job. So I hadn't to prove that they have done a poor job. They concluded themselves that it was a poor job. So that's a wonderful feeling.
Can you explain the deal you made with the bank? I mean, regarding your complaint for stalking.
It's a very difficult topic. I have to think about it first. I have to wait here. I can't drive when I say that. Huh?
Okay.
Judge said yesterday it was a deal. And yes, it was one. I agree. And
with the bank.
It was with the bank. Yeah.
if you consider this case has was going on for 6 years, from a legal point of view, the judge would have requested maybe some sentences, but we as victims, because of this harassment, would have received maybe 5, maybe 10,000 Swiss francs for compensation, and that's it. And then on top of it, I haven't had a job for several years now because of this issue. I lived for my fortune, and I'm running out of money. So, and then I do have a child, which is only 12 years, and I want to give her a proper education, because my daughter lost a lot in respect of her childhood, and that's the sort of compensation she receives. And therefore, I don't think I will lose my credibility as a whistleblower.
In the limelight. Your micron variant contains a new pattern of mutations to its spike protein. These changes could disrupt the ability of some, but probably not all, of the antibodies induced by the current vaccines to bind to the spike protein. If that happens, the vaccines could be less effective at preventing people from getting infected by and transmitting the Omicron variant. We now present you an article written by Deborah Fuller, Professor of Microbiology at the School of Medicine, University of Washington. The piece is titled, How Soon Will Omicron Vaccines Be Ready? Omicron variant of the coronavirus is different enough from the original variant, it's possible that existing vaccines won't be as effective as they have been. If so, it's likely that companies will need to update their vaccines. Deborah Fuller is a microbiologist who has been studying mRNA and DNA vaccines for over 2 decades. Here she explains why vaccines might need to be updated and what that process would entail. 1. Why might vaccines need to be updated? Basically, it's a question of whether a virus has changed enough so that antibodies created by the original vaccine are no longer able to recognize and fend off the new mutated variant. Coronaviruses use spike proteins to attach to ACE2 receptors on the surface of human cells and infect them. All mRNA COVID-19 vaccines work by giving instructions in the form of mRNA that directs cells to make a harmless version of the spike protein. This spike protein then induces the human body to produce antibodies. If a person is then ever exposed to the coronavirus, these antibodies bind to the coronavirus's spike protein and thus interfere with its ability to infect the person's cells. The Omicron variant contains a new pattern of mutations to its spike protein. These changes could disrupt the ability of some, but probably not all, of the antibodies induced by the current vaccines to bind to the spike protein. If that happens, the vaccines could be less effective at preventing people from getting infected by and transmitting the Omicron variant. How would a new vaccine be different? Existing mRNA vaccines, like those made by Moderna or Pfizer, encode for a spike protein from the original strain of coronavirus. In a new or updated vaccine, the mRNA instructions would encode for the Omicron spike protein. By swapping out the genetic code of the original spike protein for the one from this new variant, a new vaccine would induce antibodies that more effectively bind to the Omicron virus and prevent it from infecting cells. People already vaccinated or previously exposed to COVID-19 would likely need only a single booster dose of a new vaccine to be protected not only from the new strain, but also other strains that may be still in circulation. If Omicron emerges as a dominant strain over Delta, then those who are unvaccinated would only need to receive 2 to 3 doses of the updated vaccine. If Delta and Omicron are both in circulation, people would likely get a combination of the current and updated vaccines. 3. How do scientists update a vaccine? To make an update